theoretically, yeah, you can have something long enough so that it produces nodes and lessens the radiation pattern, but I don't think anyone really worries too much about it. Is it better to have two than one? In the case of the counterpoise to the NFED, one should be sufficient. I would probably try and make that one as long as you can within reason. It should be certainly shorter than your NFED, but something about half the size, say, of the NFED. In verticals, counterpoise in the form of ground planes usually direct the radiation pattern of the radiation towards where you're pointing the ground plane. So if you have a car antenna and the ground plane is your car, and if you mount it to the back of your car, the entire car is going to act as a ground plane, and it's going to distort the omnidirectional nature towards the front of your car. But that shouldn't be a big problem with an NFED because of the nature of the radiation pattern that NFEDs have. So I hope I answered most of those questions. If not, please ask again or change the wording.
KD2FYU, can I have some input?
Well, I think you mean that you want to have some output. So, yeah, please give us your experiences.
Yes, would a random length HF wire antenna with a 9-to-1 UNUN, you're going to need your counterpoise, which is the other half of the antenna. We know that. Well, we know that, okay. Now, the counterpoise wired to the other side of the 9-to-1 UNUN really is in no different plane than the long wire that you have. So if you're going to make the counterpoise wire longer, that one is going to be your major radiator. If you have no counterpoise wire, we understand that the other half of the antenna is the outside of the coax coming back to you, and you must choke that coax coming into your transceiver, without a doubt. So go longer with the counterpoise than your major wire on the UNUN, the 9-to-1 UNUN. That counterpoise becomes your major radiator, KD2FIU.
Okay, thank you for that, George. Yeah, it depends on whether he wants to do that or not. If he just wants to have the optimum count type of a counterpoise, again, something like half the size of the actual NFED would make a reasonably good counterpoise and would hopefully lessen the chances of him developing common mode reflections down his transmission line.
KD2FIU, 2/3 to 1. 2/3 of the long wire radiator to 1/3 length of the counterpoise wire, and always choke at the station. And they're both of those wires are non-resonant band wires.
Okay, George, but 2/3 to 1/3 is just another way of saying that the counterpoise is half the length of the NFED, right?
That's right, and they're non-resonant lengths. Make sure neither one is a resonant length.
Okay, now when you're saying a resonant length, you're saying a half-wave resonant length, right?
Half or quarter.
82 UDU.
Okay, Wayne, 1 second. I think I doubt that. If it's a quarter wave, you're basically just designing a vertical ground plane with a counterpoise, right?
You have to use non-resonant lengths for the ham radio bands.
Okay, I'm just saying that if you have a length of wire that is one quarter of a wavelength and a counterpoise that is one eighth of a wavelength, you basically have a kind of very poor man's vertical ground plane. The only difference is you really don't need to have a 9-to-1 balun. So it would sort of work as a quarter wave vertical, even if you put it in the horizontal position.
You want it to be an un-un, a 9-to-1 un-un, and you want one radiator to be at a non-resonant length. And, of course, these lengths have to do with how low of frequency you want to work. And then you have another one which is going to be a third of that as long. That one-third of the counterpoise length is going to reduce a lot of RF, but not all RF on the cable.
WB2KWC?
Yes, Wayne first, then we'll get to you, Ken. So, Wayne, you wanted to say something.
I just wanted to put in that he's basically recanting what happened to me where I hooked up the long wire to the ground and the ground to the long wire, and I was still making contact. So because the long wire was longer and it was hooked up to where the counterpoise should be, it became my major radiator.
Yes, indeed. That's what happened to you. You reported that a couple of weeks ago. Ken, you wanted to say something on the subject?
Yes, I just wanted to comment. I think yours and George's comment somehow got mixed up. I think you said you want to avoid a half wave. George said you also want to avoid a quarter wave, and somehow you interpreted that as saying that he recommended a quarter wave. Or am I misunderstanding?
No, I think you're misunderstanding. He mentioned, and if you include the un-un, the 9-to-1 un-un, I guess he's right. But ultimately, if you just look at the radiating pieces of equipment, if you have a monopole that's a quarter wave and you have a counterpoise that's an eighth of a wave length, you basically have a very, very badly designed ground plane vertical which acts as a decent antenna. When you start to put a 9-to-1 un-un, you get the impedance mismatches and such. But it just struck me that when you start to talk about just generally, if you have a quarter wave vertical, quarter wave radiator, it wouldn't work with the un-un, but it would work as a radiator. That was just what I was trying to put into this conversation.
Okay, I was just commenting that I think you guys were saying the same thing.
Well, George was saying that it shouldn't be a half wave or a quarter wave. I was just adding a little bit extra that if it was a quarter wave and you did away with the balun, it would work as a decent antenna. That's all.
UDU comment.
Oh, negative. It would be a high impedance antenna without the 9-to-1 un-un.
If you had a quarter wave radiator and you had an eighth wave counterpoise, how is that different to a vertical ground plane antenna? You would have something along the way of 30 ohms or 50 ohms. It would be somewhere close. It's just it would be best if you had more than one ground plane because the omnidirectional aspect of the antenna would get distorted. But it would work as an antenna without the UNUN.
UDU comment.
KD2FIU, can I finish this?
Yes, George, you can finish this.
I didn't make reference to the half-wave, quarter-wave. I said random length. Random length for the full wire and one-third of that random length. What does that bring you into? A very high impedance antenna. I wasn't making reference to half quarter. Roy, I think we got a little crossed here.
Okay, maybe I misconstrued. Wayne, you want to say something?
I wanted to put my 2 cents in. It depends on what UNUN. So if you are using a 9-to-1, it has to be a random length, a non-resident random length. If you're using a 49-to-1, which is what I'm using, it has to be a half wave, a resonant half wave antenna. So I'm using a 67-foot long wire end fed half wave.
Okay, that makes sense. When you take a half wave dipole in the center, its impedance is approximately 76 ohms in free space. When you bring it closer to the earth or you play around with how the angle of the two dipoles, you can get it to 50 ohms, but in free space it's 76. As you slide it off the center, being resonant, the impedance goes higher and higher and higher. When you get to the edge, it approaches somewhere between 2 and 3,000 ohms of impedance. So you use a 49-to-1 to bring it down, and then after that you can tweak it somewhat with an antenna tuner. In the case of a non-resident piece of wire that's end-fed, you don't have that severe high impedance. So a 9-to-1 should be sufficient to get you in the range where an antenna tuner can do the rest of the work.
I agree, Roy. Thank you.
Okay, very good. And by the way, for you people who have been following the radio and not the chat room, Tom is back in the chat room. Apparently he tried to disable the antivirus in the browser and still got warning messages. If Tom is still listening to me here, my guess is that you probably have yet another antivirus someplace that you might not be aware of that's still active, because ordinarily, it might be built into the browser. So don't know exactly where it is, but if you're getting alerts that these are sites that you shouldn't be looking at, it means that there's some active antivirus software, either good, bad, or indifferent, that might be getting triggered. So there's got to be an off switch someplace for it. So just if you're listening to me, Tom. Otherwise, the rest of you, if you want to look in on the chat room, you can see the conversation going. But thank you, Wayne. Eric, have we beaten this horse sufficiently?
Thanks a lot. I think I got a lot more information than what I was looking for. See, I'm in a restricted area, so I have to put my antenna in the attic. And so it's wrapped around. But for some reason, you know, I get the higher bands. I can get 10 up to 20. But from 40 and higher, you know, lower, it's impossible. So I was just wondering if a longer counterpoise would do it. But I guess I will keep the counterpoise at like half of what my antenna is, which is non-resonant either way. So thank you all very much.
KD2FIU.
Yes, George.
Look at it like the actual base formula of Wyndham. And I don't mean Carolina Wyndham, which is dipole. Wyndham, which is single wire. You want the 9-to-1 unun. But you want it about 15% off-center from the middle of the antenna. So if you want to make a random length at 51 feet, come back about 15% off-center from that and make your counterpoise. KD2FIU, keep in mind, Wyndham is not dipole, Wyndham is single wire. So we're working single wire and working with a very high impedance mismatching that we want in the center of the off-frequency antenna.
Okay, I hope Eric got that. Thank you, George, as always.
Yeah, I sort of understand it. I'm going to do a Google search on Wyndham and see what it all has to say.
KD2FIU, let me finish. It's not going to be Carolina Wyndham, which is dipole. It's the original Wyndham from the late 1930s. It's single wire. Single wire that are not resonant frequency each side.
Okay, very good. So Eric can look that up. And, yes, there are two Wyndhams, just to confuse you. There is the historical Wyndham antenna, and there is the newer variation, which is an off-center dipole. Any other comments on this subject before we call it an end to this particular subject? Okay, very good. Once again, this is AC2GS, and we're open to any kind of questions. If you have any further radio questions, amateur radio questions, science questions, broad-based medical questions, we're here for you. Just hit that push-to-talk button, give us your first name and your call sign.
WS2N.
Yes, Paul.
Yeah, on your site, one of your topics is the vaccines you believe might be able to last many years, according to some research. You might comment on that, back to you, Roy.
Okay, very good. That's a good idea. That's why I grabbed that one. The problem, as I mentioned before, is that it's very difficult to extrapolate long-term results if you're only had less than a year to do research on the subject. You don't have anyone who took the vaccine 5 years ago who can give you an indication of how long it's working. Also, a lot of people will go for the obvious that, just to take a blood test, you know, if you can go through time, you take a blood test and check the antibodies, and the people who have a large amount of antibodies are resistant, and so you can figure it out with a time machine and a serology test. And the problem is that the immune system, unfortunately, is not quite sure. You can't use that method, because what usually happens in the immune system is after a couple of months, the antibodies decrease by a severe rate. The theory behind it being evolutionarily that if you maintain the proper supply of antibodies for everything that you're ready to fight, your blood would be full of sludge. It would be very thick with antibodies. So what happens is you develop a population of what's called memory B cells, which remember how to produce this particular antibody and that are very sensitive to activating its production. That is exceedingly difficult to test for because it doesn't really leave any blood traces. Let me drop for a sec. What they had to do recently just to evaluate people who were infected and then vaccinated, they actually had to talk them into obtaining a bone marrow specimen from them. This is where the lymphocytes are usually stored. So they grabbed a bunch of memory B cells inside bone marrow and tested to see how many of them were working on building antibodies for the COVID virus. And they found that a year down the road, not exactly a year, maybe about 6 months, that it was very, very strong. And they're extrapolating that they think that means that at least for the first few years, people hopefully will not need a booster shot, and they may not even need a booster for the variants. We may end up, at least in the short terms, with simply as long as you've had a vaccination, including those infected, are pretty much safe. So, again, really good news. It's better than was expected by many virologists and such. So this is the first of many experiments that will continue over the next few years, along with the epidemiologists tracking infections and such, to discern whether or not we will need a booster, whether or not we will need a modified vaccine for the variants. All those things have been reported in one way or another, but they're still up in the air. The vaccine companies are designing such new vaccines if they are warranted, but they're not producing them in any numbers yet. And that's the state of the art as I understand it.
Okay, very good. Now, there was a little noise at one point on my radio, and it was right when you were talking about the bone marrow. Did you say they got people to volunteer bone marrow? Is that what you said?
Yeah, the only way that you can detect for memory B cells, lymphocytes, is that they're in your bone marrow. So they actually had to ask for volunteers. It's not a simple blood test. It was a bone marrow. They needed to extract bone marrow from all the test subjects in order to figure out if they have a proper number of memory B cells. So it's a big pain in the backside. I there are more than a few people out there who have gone for bone marrow tests and such. It's very uncomfortable. It's not something as simple as a blood test, unfortunately.
Yes, I know that. It's amazing that they got these people to volunteer for that. Very good. Well, I think that's they're giving awards out and people are winning lotteries, and these people should get something for that. Back to you, Roy. That's terrific.
Yes, indeed. There are a lot of great people out there. Unfortunately, when you listen to the news, you tend to hear about the nuts. You don't hear about the great people who dedicate their lives or to have a really miserable day or two in a hospital. But there are people like that out there, and it's just it's nice to know that they're there as well as the nuts. So that's that story. I also wanted to mention to you people, last week there was a discourse on switching power supplies, and I've been kind of looking into the state of the art of switching power supplies. Apparently, when switching power supplies were first being developed, it was the early days of semiconductors. They were using bipolar batteries as the switching part of the system. Now, we mentioned last week that the way that a switching power supply works Well, the way a linear power supply works, which is a far older design, is relatively simple. You put in either 240 or 120 volts AC from your utility line. You put it into a large, massive power transformer that will either increase or decrease the voltage in AC. That goes out the secondary. Then there's usually a bridge rectifier, which changes the AC to a DC. Then there's some smoothing capacitors. Then sometimes there's a smoothing inductor, and then sometimes there's a voltage regulator at the very end. They're big, they're bulky, they're inefficient, they produce a lot of waste heat. Like I said, they're heavy as heck and somewhat expensive. Switching power supplies work somewhat differently. They take the AC, they go through another bridge rectifier into DC, but at 120 volts. They then get fed into a switching circuit that increases the cycle rate in the kilohertz range. And because it's a kilohertz, it's able to more efficiently go through a much smaller, lighter transformer, and that will decrease or increase the voltage. Then you got another full bridge rectifier, some smoothing capacitors or inductor, and a voltage regulator. And so they're smaller, they're lighter, they're cheaper, they're easier. They do have a tendency to spew some RF if poorly designed, but filtering fixes a lot of them. Let me drop for a sec.
WP2EAV.
Yes, Ed.
Yes, absolutely. But the key point to remember is that by turning your 60 cycles into DC and then turning it into, nowadays it's hundreds of kilohertz, you can use an absolutely tiny transformer instead of that big hunk of iron. And the second item that you have not mentioned is you mentioned a voltage regulator. But by playing with the duty cycle of those waveforms, you can tweak the voltage without wasting power. A linear voltage regulator has to throw away the excess voltage as lost power. By tweaking the duty cycle of the waveforms, you just adjust the output to match the input, and it's much more, that's where the efficiency really comes in. Back to you, Roy.
Okay, very good, Ed. Yeah, I was just starting at the very beginning when things were rather primitive. They realized that bipolar transistors are really not great for any of this. They tend to have very slow switching rates. They can't bring it very high, which is why they weren't that fast when they were first put in. But then they started working on metal oxide surface field effects transistors, which are a much more sleek design. Using that, it went. MOSFETs are current driven and are voltage driven rather than bipolar transistors, which are current driven, and they are capable of much higher switching switching frequencies. And you can introduce pulse width modulation in driver devices in order to adjust the voltage, as Ed just mentioned. The new thing, and the reason why I brought this subject up tonight, is there's a sort of new semiconductor material. It's been around for about 20 years, but it's being brought into the field of power transistors. You might know gallium nitride as the semiconductor that allowed for the famous blue-colored LED. It's been around for a while. It's very difficult to actually do much with. Right now, the way that they're utilizing it for gallium nitride field effects transistors is to put a layer of gallium nitride on top of a regular silicon wafer. The silicon wafer stabilizes it. And so they're using these new things called enhanced gallium nitride field effects transistors, and it's doing some interesting things. Let me drop for a sec. Okay. The voltage drop, the band gap or voltage drop of the gallium nitride is much higher than for silicon. So because of that, the switching transistors made from this material can use higher voltages. They can use the higher voltages, and they can also run at higher switching frequencies. So with the increase in the frequency, you get to shrink the transformers again. And using a driver with pulse width modulation, you can again improve the efficiency. Some of these gallium nitride-based switching power supplies can have as much as 97% efficiency, which is very, very good. Right now, they're a little bit more expensive than the old standby. They're slowly creeping into the general usership. You can soon buy gallium nitride-based power supplies on Amazon. There's a little bit of a premium. And the difference is, again, that they're smaller, lighter, more compact, and they have much more power than anything close to their size. So check out gallium nitride. It's a fascinating subject, and it's set to revolutionize power switching power supply. So I just thought I would add that. Anyway, that's my little spiel on gallium nitride and switching power supplies. Anyone with any other questions, science-related, technology, amateur radio, and broad-based medicine, please feel free. Okay, I hear someone out there. It's a very erratic. It's mostly noise, and it drops out of the repeater. So if you could either raise the gain of your radio, or if it's a handy talkie, put it closer to the window, or go outside, or go on a hill or something, and somehow get better reception from the repeater.
All right, it's Frank BSO. He's trying to get through Echo Link.
Alpha Delta 2, Bravo Oscar.
Yes, Bravo Oscar.
Bravo Oscar. Russell from Quorum currently.
I didn't hear all that. I please try again. No, I'm sorry. It's about 95% noise. I don't know. Again, if maybe change the position. If it's a handy talkie. Or raise the output a little bit.
US2N.
Yes, Paul.
Yeah, Frank BXL was trying to get in before, so he might have doubled with the other station, but I heard him very clearly out here, so you might want to pick him up on Echo Link.
Okay, back to AD2BO. I'm sorry, it's very, very noisy. Maybe try and figure out a better location. I'll get back to you in a couple of minutes. Frank on Echo Link, you have a comment or a question?
I guess I'm good. And, Paul. EMR. A friend of mine told me my EMR radio was got it back to me, and I'm trying to verify it actually works properly, and I'm not having very much luck with the local repeaters in the Philadelphia area. Again?
Okay, and unfortunately, I have a neighbor who's sending very powerful VHF transmissions simultaneously to me listening to you. So some of that was broken up. I got the idea that you have a friend who has a DMR and you want to check something about it. If you could restate it for me, please. Okay, what kind of equipment do you have? Do you have a hotspot or not? Okay. Unfortunately, my charming neighbor is just keeps on chatting away. I don't know. He's kind of flooded my spectrum. Could anyone out there who doesn't have a neighbor who's flooding their spectrum restate Frank's question so that I could figure out what the question is, please?
WS2N.
Yes, Paul. Please help me here.
A friend of his programmed a DMR for him. He sent it back to him. Now he wants to test it out. He's trying to get it to local repeaters, but nothing seems to be active. He does not have a hotspot, not yet. And he's looking to try to get on DMR. He wants to know if anybody could help him out. Back to you, Roy.
Okay, thank you very much, Paul. That's a big problem. If you don't have a repeater, then the only thing, well, I mean, you could have a simplex point-to-point with another DMR, but that probably won't suffice to what you're interested in of trying to access talk groups and all kinds of things. So I'm not quite sure exactly how you could go about testing these things if there is if there's no local repeater that will give you access. You might want to contact them and ask them if and what the problem might be. They might be a very strange repeater group that require you to check in with your ID number before they give you access. I haven't seen of any repeaters like that, but I guess they might exist somewhere.
W2BZ.
Yes, Rich.
I tried Parrot to see if he'll parrot back what he says into it.
Yeah, but Parrot requires you to get into a repeater or a hotspot. You can't just parrot nothingness. So if, as Frank mentions, he's having problems getting into a local repeater and he doesn't have a hotspot, how would you arrange Parrot to work?
I thought Parrot was, you know, totally internal, but you're right. You would need a repeater or a hotspot to parrot back what you just said into the mic.
Yeah, Frank, you got a puzzler for me. The problem is that obviously you need something to work off of the DMR radio, either a local repeater or a hotspot. So I don't offhand know what to tell you. If anyone out there has any brilliant ideas of how you test a DMR radio in things like talk groups and such without either of those, please volunteer it. Okay, very good. So you have the repeaters, but they're not really responding to you. Do you have them configured to the right time slot? Because DMR repeaters have two different time slots, and one of them usually is used for local communications. The other one is used for network. They use something called the C bridge to communicate to different talk groups. So theoretically, if you have your handy talkie or DMR radio switched in to the non-local one, and it's not really set for any particular talk group, you would just end up being talking to yourself. So have you tried both time slots? Have you tried different talk groups?
Well, I'm
Yes, Ken.
I'm thinking of all the buttons on the radio, and the one that would, I guess, most likely screw things up, I don't think color codes or time slots is something you can really mess up from a front panel button, but how about the reverse button? Is it possible you're transmitting on the repeater output and listening on the repeater input? I don't think I won't say it's possible. I'm sure nobody is going to be that because the other things seem unlikely to be able to change from the front panel, or even if you change them from the front panel, they're usually not saved in the code plug, so that turning the radio off and back on again would send you back to the code plug rather than the stuff that you've programmed from the front panel.
Another question, Frank. What model DMR are you using?
Yeah.
and radio are a little anomalous in the way they're set up compared to the other radio. KWC, you probably know that.
W2BZ?
Yes.
One way I was told you could injure these radios if you try to transmit while they're in the charging socket. So watch out for that. I don't know if it's true. I've only heard it a couple of times, but that's enough for me. Go ahead. Back to net.
Okay, I don't think that's the problem, because usually you're not pushing on the push-to-talk button while you're sitting there with it in the charger. So I'm thinking that there's something else odd going on. And the reverse button, usually it's a kind of a temporary thing. While you're pressing the reverse button, it's reversed, but when you let go, it goes away. So this is a curious finding. I'm not quite sure exactly why you're having such a hard problem. Again, lately they've been designing DMR radios that are kind of too easy. They have this ability called digimonitoring, so that you can hear other streams that you're not really connected to. So in other words, you can set the radio can be set for a digital monitoring of all the talk groups. But if you don't have that particular talk group encoded in your machine at that time and enabled, when you send a packet, it won't include that talk group, so the repeater won't know what you want to do with it because it doesn't have a talk group entered into it. So that might be what's going on, and the reason why you're hearing talk groups in what's called promiscuous mode, but because your code plug isn't set for that talk group, it's not able to send the signal to that talk group, and so no one will respond to you.
Monitor issue, and I believe I turned DigiMonitor off next to the signal strength thing.
Okay, the way mine works is you hit the star key while the person is transmitting. That will set your particular radio for that talk group for X number of minutes, depending upon how you set that setting. There's a timeout feature that if you have it set for whatever, 15 or 30 minutes, after 15 or 30 minutes, it will default back to whatever it was before. But if it's like mine, the star should be pressed while the person is transmitting so that the handy talkie can read his talk group.
I have an outrageous thought. WB2EAV.
Please, Ed, outrage us.
He said at the beginning, a friend of his set it up for him. Apparently the friend set it up, but didn't tell him how it's set up. Maybe he should ask the friend.
As always, that's an excellent idea, Ed. It's always good to know more information. It's always good to download the code plug and try to make sense of it. We all learn from these things as best we can. So Frank, your friend who set it up, is he accessible? And what does he say when you tell him these things? That's good. It is really like a completely different language. It has very little to do with most FM analog radio technology or programming languages for HF radios or such. It's not even as simple as a D-Star or Fusion from Yaesu. It's a very esoteric. It has all kinds of interesting things like time slots and color instead of PL tones. It has talk groups and contact lists, and then it lists the channels not, you know, from one end to the other, but it packs them away in smaller groups that are only accessible in those groups, so it can take a little bit of training to figure out exactly what's going on. So, I mean, I don't know. Offhand, I don't know otherwise what to tell you as far as what's causing the problem. The simplest problem is that for some reason, even though you think the digital monitoring is off, it may have switched back on, and you're just not capturing the talk group that you're trying to. It's difficult to say, you know, without being there, but I don't know. If anyone else has any words of wisdom, please feel free.
Show you the screen on video and see if there's something obvious I'm missing. I suspect that it's one of two things. Either I'm placing it through a computer, and that's why I'm not hearing myself in the parrot. My audio is just not being heard most of the time, even though by sheer luck I made one contact. Or I accidentally changed the setting, so my audio is being transmitted. I would suspect the problem is very simple. Anyway, you did elucidate how to handle the DigiMonitor and the star key function and confirm what my buddy had explained. He wasn't actually certain whether I had a hit star before or after the guy dropped the carrier. So I will experiment with that a little. I'll let you go on with the next note. It's always quite helpful. And my call at ARRL.net should work if somebody wants to, is so inclined to contact me and, try to get on, Zoom or FaceTime or something and, try to figure it out. Feel free to connect. No, this is too serious.
Okay, very good. Let me just try something here. Okay. Very good. I wish you luck. Please, if you figure it out, come back and tell us so that we will have another trick on under our sleeve to offer other people. So thanks a lot.
Yeah, absolutely. I'll send you an email or I'll try to be here. I'm sure I'll stumble on the solution. And it may be as simple as having a poor signal into the repeater. Talk to you later. UB2BXO.
Okay, very good, Frank. Just another note on Echolink. Let's see here. Nick, N2HVR, asks, what about that big asteroid that's going to pass us? I pulled it up. Let me take a look again. Okay, apparently there are five asteroids arriving in the coming days. Let's see. The largest asteroid is designated 2021 KT1. They say it'll make contact to Earth, approach to Earth. It's not going to make contact, God forbid. June 1st, arriving within 4.5 million miles of Earth. The smaller asteroids will approach the Earth Saturday, Sunday, and Monday. Those come in approximately within 1.9 million to 3.6 million miles of Earth, and these asteroids are the size of airplanes and an average house. So that's the big, small, and in-between of the five asteroids that are going to be coming close to us in the next week. Okay, once again, anyone out there with any other questions or comments for the Technical Net tonight?
Let me see if I got it right. This is NL3NO. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can, Tom. How are you doing?
Well, I've gone from ridiculously frustrated to insanely frustrated. Behind the scenes, I've been working with my CC Tech Net, a very nice fellow named Chris, on the net. Thank you, Chris, public accolade there. It seems that, according to my PC guy, that Google itself on the server is blocking the file coming down. Because it's seeing them as files, as active programs, even though they're zip, and is blocking them because it thinks that they are evil.
Hopefully. Okay, Tom, I got two questions. One is, is it possible that it may not be the Google? I assume when you say Google, you're talking about your web browser. Your Google Chrome web browser, although Chris mentions Gmail. So which is it?
It's not my local Google. The tech at my company suggested that it's Google Prime, you know, the server company, you know, God Mecca type Google. It's them. And I'm saying to myself, I got to think about that a while. But it makes sense.
Okay, let me ask you a completely different question. Have you tried any other browser than Google Chrome?
Affirmative. I tried that Microsoft variant. I can't think of the name right now. That didn't work. I'm now trying Firefox. I'm going to see if that works.
Okay, the Microsoft is called Edge. It too is Chrome-based. So all of these things, Firefox, Edge, and Google, are all Chrome-based. What you might want to try is if you have an old copy of Internet Explorer on your computer, That's the old, old one that Microsoft promised to get rid of any day now. It's not Chrome-based.